As Pastor Williams and I were praying prior to this morning, he made the observation, which of course I also am aware of, that this is not so much a time of preaching the gospel, though I trust it'll savor of the gospel. It has to do with the gospel. It is a time of relating history and setting before us examples of faithful Christians by which we can benefit in that example, be encouraged, and God willing and with his help, emulate, that is, in their faithfulness. So it's my blessing to be able to speak with you this morning about Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, their lives, their ministry, and their death. The history of the Whitmans' missionary work and martyr deaths has been greatly, greatly revised and distorted by secular historians, by Catholic historians, and even by Roman priests at that time. One particular Jesuit bishop who put out a tract after the massacre, which we'll be hearing about here as we go along, totally distorting the history. And there have been other such things. And then it doesn't help any that ill-informed evangelicals have added to the confusion with books and videos which are filled with many distortions and falsehoods. Now, I want to set a few sources before you, things I've been drawing from for this presentation. A main source, which I'll share much from today, is an out-of-print book called Marcus Whitman, Pathfinder and Patriot. It was written by the Reverend Myron Eales, copyright 1909. Now, Eales was judged by his contemporaries to be mentally and morally honest to the core. The father of Myron Eales was Reverend Cushing Eales. You'll hear of him later. He was a very close associate to the Whitmans in the ministry in Oregon. He was also the founder of Whitman Seminary and College. Now, this book is filled with quotes from the diaries and the letters and the documents written by Dr. Whitman, his wife Narcissa, also the Reverend Henry Spaulding and his wife, who traveled to the Oregon Territory with the Whitmans, and they were co-workers there and fast friends right up to the death of the Whitmans. The book also contains quotes from other key figures relating to our subject. Another source I've accessed is letters, additional letters, written by the Whitmans, which are preserved by the Whitman Mission National Historic Site. And then I've also included some information, or used it, incorporated it, that was actually collected by the U.S. Senate after the massacre. I've also drawn information from the book The Whitman Massacre of 1847 by Catherine, Elizabeth, and Matilda Sager, mostly using the things Catherine includes. Now, the Sagers were adopted children of the Whitmans. In 1844, the Sager family started out on the Oregon Trail, as it was soon called, for the Oregon Territory. On the way, both parents died. And so when the train finally made it to the Whitman Station in Oregon, actually near present-day Walla Walla, Washington, the Whitmans took in those orphans. Now, the information I use from the Sager book is also eyewitness reports, including excerpts from diaries and letters of that godly, reliable, and courageous H.H., that is, Henry Harmon Spaulding, the Whitman's co-worker. Then I've also included things I've gotten from other sources, but the main thing is that I strove to be very, very accurate, preferring eyewitness accounts from the very events and time over anything else, and always trying to corroborate everything by more than one source. Now, I'm going to be talking about the Oregon Territory. At the time of the events I'm covering, that territory consisted of what is now the states of Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and then parts of Montana and Wyoming. Often at that time, the region, especially the parts making up Oregon and Washington and part of Idaho, at least, were often referred to as just Oregon. So I may do that, and you'll have to keep that in mind as we go along. It's not necessarily that I'm talking about just the state of Oregon. In 1811, John Jacob Astor, an American fur trader, established a post in the Oregon Territory near Astoria, which is on the very northern border of present-day Washington and right by the Pacific coast. But until the territory eventually passed over to the sole possession of the United States of America, which was in 1846, it was utterly dominated and essentially governed by the Hudson Bay Company, which established Fort Vancouver in 1812, and then other forts as well. I'm going to speak about the Hudson Bay Company more as we go along, because it's very important to the events that took place subsequent to the Whitmans arriving in Oregon. We need to understand that powerful monopoly that was the Hudson Bay Company. Now, very early on, the United States and Great Britain were at odds as to which country should have possession of the Oregon Territory. In 1818, the two countries signed a treaty which allowed for joint possession. And that was the situation when the Whitmans established their mission in 1836. Now, Marcus Whitman was born at Rushville, Yates County, New York, September 4th, 1802, to Beza and Alice Whitman. In 1810, when Marcus was just short of 8 years old, his father died. At that point, he was sent to live with his paternal grandfather, Deacon Samuel Whitman, Plainfield, Massachusetts. He was originally Congregational. He was in the Congregational church after about 9 years. He then became a Presbyterian. He joined that church, and he was in it till he died. He was elected an elder in 1833. Marcus studied Latin and Greek under Reverend Moses Halleck, and then he set his sights on being a minister. But his brothers discouraged him, in part because of his poverty, and so he took up the study of medicine. This was under Dr. Ira Brandt. He received his diploma 3 years later in 1824. He first practiced medicine in Canada and then 4 more years in Wheeler, New York. But he had developed a strong and unrelenting desire and conviction to take the gospel to the heathen. Now, to that end, Marcus wrote the American Board of Commissioners for the Foreign Missions at Boston. That was, at that time, a combined missionary society of the Congregational and Presbyterian churches. The letter, dated June 3, 1834, includes these excerpts. I regard the missionary cause as based on the atonement and the commands and promises of the Lord Jesus Christ to his ambassadors and church, and that it involves the holiness and happiness of all that may be reclaimed from sin. I esteem it the duty of every Christian to seek the advancement of the cause of Christ. I am willing to go to any field of usefulness at the direction of the American Board. I will cooperate as physician, teacher, or agriculturalist so far as I am able, if required. I wanted to go out preaching the gospel, sharing the gospel, and doing anything else that needed to be done. Now, the future wife of Marcus Whitman was born in Prattsburn, New York, March 14, 1808. She was the third of 9 children. She was the daughter of Judge Stephen Prentice. Her name was Narcissa. As was the case with Marcus, she could trace her ancestry in America all the way back to the first part of the 17th century, soon after the landing of the Pilgrims. Her family were Congregationalists. As an adult, she was a Presbyterian. Prior to her marriage, she was very active in Christian work. She had a real heart for the gospel. And she was very active in Sabbath school work and always wanting to share the gospel with others and busy about that. Narcissa had a very strong desire to be in missionary work. So she applied to the American Board, writing, "Feeling it more my privilege than duty to labor for the conversion of the heathen, I respectfully submit myself to your direction." In 1835, Dr. Whitman was accepted by the American Board of Commissioners for the Foreign Missions, which hereafter I'll just call the Board or the Missions Board. He was given the commission along with Reverend Samuel Parker to set out for Oregon and commence a mission work there, do the necessary preparatory work, and set up a mission in time. Now, in 1835, the two left for Oregon. They traveled first to St. Louis. Then, leaving there on April 8th, they went up the Missouri River to Liberty, where they joined the annual caravan of the American Fur Company. After another month of travel, they reached the annual rendezvous of fur trappers and traders and Indians on the Green River. That's a branch of the Colorado River in what is now Wyoming. Dr. Whitman wrote to the missions board in a letter dated November 7, 1835, "We found most of the traders and trappers of the mountains, together with bands of about 2,000 Shoshone and Snake Indians," and he goes on to tell of other Indians as well, a large number. Now, I want to mention the obvious. I'm quoting from letters. These letters were sent, so to speak, by reliable individuals that carried them back east, and letters that came from the east were brought the same way. And then once the Whitmans were in Oregon, they sent some letters by ship around Cape Horn and then back up the Atlantic coast. Now, at this rendezvous, the missionaries' lives ended up being threatened by certain officials of the American Fur Company. They said they were going to kill Marcus Whitman and Samuel Parker, specifically because they kept the Sabbath and abstained from all alcoholic beverages. Now, there may have been a profit motive here, since the American Fur Company at that time maintained a distillery at the mouth of the Yellowstone River. Now, before the Fur Company officials could carry out their threats, cholera broke out at the rendezvous, and Dr. Whitman, under God, was able to save many lives. Another thing that earned Whitman lasting respect and affection among the mountain men was several successful operations which he performed on their number. In one case, he extracted an iron arrowhead 3 inches long out of the back of Captain Jim Bridger. You maybe heard of him. This famous mountain man had received the wound and the arrowhead 3 years earlier in a fight with the Blackfeet Indians. And then Dr. Whitman also was able to perform a similar operation on a man, also removing an arrowhead and arrow out of the back of a man who had carried it for a year and a half. Now, Parker and Whitman used their time at the rendezvous to gather relevant information on Oregon. And then they made the decision that Marcus should go back east to recruit more missionaries, and Parker would go out to the Oregon Territory and do advanced exploration and gather different information needed in the Oregon Territory. Well, it's unfortunate that Parker didn't follow through. He went to Oregon and then got on a ship and went back home around Cape Horn. So he wasn't there to meet Whitman, the Whitmans, and the Spaldings, that little missionary party that then started back. He was supposed to meet them at the rendezvous. Arriving home, Marcus, following through on what he said he would do, recruited R.H. Spalding, the Reverend R.H. Spalding, and his wife, as well as a William H. Gray, as missionaries to the Oregon Territory. He also recruited Narcissa Prentice and asked her to marry him, which she gladly consented to. That wedding took place on the very eve of the missionary band starting for the Oregon Territory. Now, this would be the last time any of Narcissa's family or Christian brethren would see of her this side of heaven. Marcus had already warned her before they committed to marrying of the hard toil and dangers that awaited on the other side of the Rocky Mountains. To this, Narcissa replied, "It is God's work. I will go." The Whitmans were married on February 1836 in the church Narcissa attended, among the people that greatly loved her. One hymn that was given out to be sung included these lines: "Yes, my native land, I love thee. All thy scenes, I love them well. Friends, connections, happy country, now I bid you all farewell." As the hymn began, one by one in the congregation dropped out, filled with emotion, unable to sing, some openly sobbing. By the closing line, only one person was singing. It was Narcissa, who had a beautiful voice, and she sang to the very end of the hymn with an unwavering voice. In March of 1836, the missionary band, consisting of the Spauldings, the Whitmans, and William Gray, set out for Oregon. They again traveled with a band of the American Fur Company, and they endured, of course, many dangers and trials and privations on this trip. I don't have time to share these things. I'll just mention one danger. There was a certain point when the caravan was almost destroyed by a huge herd of buffalo. These buffaloes were hidden in some hills until the caravan got almost to that place, and then they all came bursting out of the mountains, headed right for the wagons. And all the men that were able rushed to the front and began shooting buffaloes as fast as they could, as the buffaloes just kept coming. And at the last minute, by the grace of God, they swerved to one side. Now, during much of the journey, Mrs. Spaulding, Eliza, was deathly ill, and she was close to dying a number of times. She was unable to eat much. She was just utterly miserable. At one point, she told her husband, "Go on and save yourself and carry the book of God to those Indians. I shall never see them. My work is done. But bless God, he has brought me thus far. Tell my mother I am not sorry that I came." When her husband finally urged Mrs. Spaulding to stay at Fort Laramie then, Mrs. Spaulding replied, "What mean ye to weep and break my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but to die at Jerusalem or in the Rocky Mountains, if need be, for the name of the Lord Jesus. Duty is mine. My life, my strength, the dangers of the way are his. I like the command just as it is. Go ye into all the world, and no exceptions for poor health." Now, eventually, in the mercy of God, Mrs. Spaulding regained her health. In Marcus Whitman, Pathfinder and Patriot, Reverend Myron Eales wrote, "July 4th, they entered the South Pass of the Rocky Mountains, the dividing line between the Atlantic and Pacific slopes. There on Independence Day, they," that is the missionaries, "alighted from their horses, and kneeling down with the Bible and the American flag in their hands, they took possession of the Pacific coast as a home of American mothers and for the Church of Christ. They thank God for his sustaining, protecting care over them. And stand we did," says Mr. Spaulding, "upon the summit of those sky-built mountains, with the bright forms of Brainerd, of Butler, of Elliot, and Worcester, early missionaries to the Indians on the Atlantic shores, almost in sight, bending over the pearly gates of heaven to bid us Godspeed." It bears mentioning that no white women had ever stood where Mrs. Whitman and Mrs. Spaulding were standing. On July 6th, the caravan arrived at the annual rendezvous on the Green River, where there was gathered about 400 to 500 mountain men and 15 tribes of Indians. Now, at these rendezvous, the warring tribes would observe a temporary but very tense truce. Let me give you another quote from Reverend Eales. They were met first by the Indians, this little missionary band. And then Reverend Eales records, "Lastly, the mountain men and trappers came, wishing to see the white women, as many of them had not seen one for years since they had been in the mountains. From that day," said one of them, as he thought of the home of his early childhood, of his mother and sisters and purity, "from that day I was a better man." Mrs. Whitman became a great favorite with the mountain men, and she had much influence with them. These rough men were so appreciative of Narcissa's grace and her refined manners, and they treated her with such politeness that it bordered on reverence. Now, the rendezvous had many spectacular aspects, including the sight of hundreds of Indians displaying, one tribe at a time, their horsemanship and their warring abilities, doing mock battles. And these displays then provoked additional tension between the warring tribes present. At the end of the rendezvous, the Whitman party continued toward Oregon. This time they were with Hudson Bay traders, because the American Fur Company had been effectively shut out from most of the Oregon territory by Hudson Bay. And a quote from Reverend Eales again, "When Captain Bridger, the famous mountaineer, said goodbye at this rendezvous to Dr. Whitman, he He thanked the doctor very heartily for extracting an arrowhead from his backbone the year before and promised to send his half-breed daughter, Mary Ann, to Dr. Whitman's mission when she should be old enough. This promise he fulfilled, and she remained at the doctor's as long as she lived. And she was there when the massacre took place, and she was taken hostage by the Indians. Now, I should mention that the record shows that the traders and the mountain men at the rendezvous, who were no strangers to adversity or the doing of things said to be impossible by others, these men strongly urged Dr. Whitman to leave the wagons from this point on. The unanimous opinion was that there was no chance of them taking their wagons through the mountains, then through the burning sands of Snake Country, no chance of getting the rest of the way through Wyoming and Idaho and on into Oregon. But the missionary party led by Dr. Whitman pushed on with their wagons. At Fort Hall, Idaho, in what is now southeastern Idaho, Dr. Whitman and his party were again urged to leave the wagons, but again they continued on with them through many more dangers and near disasters, through all sorts of terrain, and with hostile Indian attack a real possibility. As you can imagine, the going was very hard, the food was very basic, including game killed along the way, clothing was washed in the rivers, guards were posted night and day. Increasingly non-essential items of the missionary party were strewn along the way. Mrs. Whitman wrote in her journal on the Lord's Day, August 7th, "Was there ever a journey like this performed where the sustaining hand of God has been so manifest every morning? Surely the children of Israel could not have been more sensible of the pillar of fire by night than we have been of that hand that has led us safely thus on. God has heard prayer in our behalf, and even now, while I am writing on this holy day, is the sweet incense of prayer ascending before the throne of heavenly grace." On August 27th, Narcissa wrote of the intense heat and the sandy plain they were in. They were traveling through at that time. There was no shade whatsoever except what during rest periods they could rig up with some blankets. And she wrote, "Sometimes my wicked heart has been disposed to murmur, thinking I have no rest from the heat." But she also wrote, "Under the circumstances, I have never wished to go back. Such a thought never finds a place in my heart. The Lord is better to us than our fears. I always find it so." Now finally, after traveling across Idaho and halfway up its length, the Whitman party arrived at a fort Marcus calls Snake Fort, in a letter on September 5th. Now here, there was much urging again, leave your wagons. And he did agree to leave the wagons and pack the rest of the way on mules. But this didn't satisfy the mountain men and others that were urging, in reality, that the missionary party just stop and go back. The issue now was the two women, Mrs. Whitman and Mrs. Spaulding. Mountain men and traders labored to turn the missionary party back because these two women were along. And some said it would be manslaughter to go any further with these two women. The going was rough, of course, but also a party which had previously attempted to take a white woman through to Oregon was ambushed and slaughtered, and the woman led away by the Indians, never to be heard from again. But the missionary party, with one accord, resolved to press on for Oregon. Mr. Spaulding later wrote of Mrs. Whitman and Mrs. Spaulding, "These feeble women were selected of God to settle the question by their own sacrifice and trials and hardships that white women and wagons and cattle could cross the mountains. The gold of California and of the world could not have induced them to undertake what they did, but God knew the power that would move them. He brought a single short sentence from the words of Jesus, 'Go teach all nations,' to bear upon their minds, and behold the stupendous national results." Now finally, after 6 months of dangers and toils and sacrifices, the Whitmans, the Spauldings, and William Gray reached Fort Walla Walla, a Hudson Bay company Post and Ford in what is now the state of Washington and right on the border, the northern border of what is now the state of Oregon. Now, we have to have some understanding of the Hudson Bay Company. This is essential as we continue on with the lives, the ministry, and ultimately the deaths of Marcus Narcissa Whitman. This company was formed in London in 1670. It received a charter from the English king. The purpose of the company was trading in the wilderness of British-held North America. The company was granted very far-reaching powers by the king, and it virtually became the law executed by company governors wherever it was firmly established, which was eventually most of Canada, parts of Alaska, and then, of course, much of the Oregon Territory. The Hudson Bay Company was granted a monopoly over trade in the areas covered by its charter, and once it was well established, it spared no means to make certain it kept a monopoly. Certainly, that was the situation in that part of the Oregon Territory where the Whitmans and Spauldings and William Gray began their missionary labors among the Indians. Now, among the Hudson Bay Company governors, agents, traders, and other employees, there were both good and bad, decent and tyrannical, Protestant, and in many cases, Roman Catholic. Although this was a British company, there were many Roman Catholics involved in its function due to the fact that a good number of Frenchmen and some Irishmen were employed. The central overriding object of the Hudson Bay Company management was profit, and there were fortunes to be made in North America by traders, especially in fur. So the ability to make the company money was what mattered, and anything that interfered with that ability was seen as being something to deal with and eliminate. It didn't matter the religion of anyone working for this company. It didn't matter. What mattered was profit. So I wanted to stress that. I wanted to stress that because you're wondering, British as I go along, Roman Catholic, what? How could this be? I want to also stress that no British, and the British essentially controlled the Oregon Territory at this time, no British Protestant ministers or missionaries had come to Oregon up to and during the time covered by this presentation. Roman Catholic Jesuits did come, including from Canada, but the only Protestant missionaries were Americans. And they were seen by the British Hudson Bay Company as a threat to British control of the Oregon Territory, and thus the monopoly and the profits of the company. We'll talk about that more as we go along. The Roman priests, on the other hand, were seen as a check on American interests in the territory, which was then jointly held by Britain and America, but for all practical purposes ruled by Britain through the Hudson Bay Company. So to keep these facts in mind as we continue on will be beneficial, I would say be crucial. Keep in mind also that according to the Treaty of 1818, Britain and the United States had joint occupancy of the Oregon Territory, but our country at that time, when the Whitmans first came, up until that time, had made no effort to encourage immigration of Americans there, and the Hudson Bay Company virtually ruled that portion of the territory. Now, upon the arrival of the Whitman Party in Oregon, it was thought best to send the women some 200 miles west on the Columbia River to Fort Vancouver and leave them there while Mr. Spaulding and Dr. Whitman and William Gray then scouted out places to establish their mission stations. The location Dr. Whitman first had in mind was vetoed. It was rejected by the Hudson Bay Company out of fears that if he put a station in that spot, it might somehow interfere with Hudson Bay profit. So Dr. Whitman then selected for his mission a site on the Walla Walla River at the mouth of Mill Creek, 6 miles from the present city of Walla Walla and 25 miles from then Fort Walla Walla. The place is called Wai'itlatpu. A house was built, The horses and cattle and goods were left there. Mr. Gray was put in charge. Then Reverend Spaulding and Dr. Whitman went to Nez Perce country, and there they set up a station for the Spauldings. This was about 90 miles away from the Whitman station. It was near what's now Lewiston, Idaho, just over the Washington state border into Idaho, the border that's there now. Now, this arrangement then put Dr. Whitman squarely among the Cayuse Indians. It put Reverend Spaulding with the Nez Perce. Now, it's not as if these two tribes were a long way apart with regard to their character and ways. There were some differences, though, which had a great bearing on future events. The Nez Perces were more thoughtful and moderate, not so proud. They were also much more resistant to Roman Catholic missionaries that would soon be coming. And as a whole, the Nez Perces were not near as treacherous as the Cayuse. Mr. Spaulding's station among them met much success. It's not to say that the majority, they were a big tribe, it's not to say the majority got saved, but a good number were, and many more were savored by the preaching of the gospel and the teaching of Christian doctrine and their brethren who were Christians then. At two protracted preaching meetings, which Reverend Spaulding held in 1838. Remember, this is 1836, but we jumped to 1838 and 1841. Thousands of Nez Perce attended. A school which was raised up among the Nez Perce flourished. A church was soon founded, and a small, steady number of Indians made application for membership. One of those was an Indian named Joseph, who was the father of the brilliant and principled and moderate Nez Perce, who would be known in history as Chief Joseph. You've maybe heard of him. I will fight no more forever. Now, it was the lot of Marcus Narcissa Whitman to minister principally to the Cayuse tribe. This was a little bit smaller tribe, but they were very rich, that is, in horses. They were influential beyond their numbers. They were, in general, very proud. They were haughty. They were stiff-necked. They were truculent, they were treacherous, they were cruel. They subsisted on hunting, fishing, salmon, digging roots, and gathering berries. The tribal leaders, though, expressed a great desire, hoping for benefit, of course, of some kind, to have the Whitmans settle in their territory, and then they gave them land, deeded land over to them on which to develop their mission station. Now, the Cayuse believed that the animals and the birds and the reptiles and the fish were once men who inhabited the world before the present race of men. They believed that the beasts, although forever consigned to their present state, still retained a language among themselves, and that the animals and birds and reptiles and fish had the power to convey that language to those people they wished to convey it to. Now, to get the language of the creatures, young men among the Cayuse would stay in the mountains alone, and they would fast until they supposedly had a supernatural event take place and they had the language of the beasts. And then they would go back and act as a communicator for the creatures. Not all of them. Some said they had such reverence for this language and the wisdom contained that they couldn't even share it, but others acted as communicators for the creatures. It was claimed that the beasts would reveal the future character of those to whom they spoke. They would reveal how to secure honor and wealth and long life. They would reveal how to become invulnerable, but if wounded, how to heal oneself, including by various methods such as sitting in a stream of water, running water, and singing a specific magical song. Also communicated was how to shoot an invisible arrow or an invisible influence so that disease and death would follow in the enemy that it was shot at. Sorcery was practiced by the Cayuse medicine men. They sang hideous songs, and they beat on everything with sticks, and they made contortions, and they uttered incoherent expressions. They would claim to extract evil by placing their hands on people. They said evil in the person could be extracted, specifically diseases could be extracted. And then when it was, then the medicine man would fall down on the floor. He would drive off the evil, and he would do all sorts of writhing and contortions and so on. When a patient died, the medicine man would watch his face for signs which he claimed allowed him to discern the person whose medicine was stronger than his and was responsible for the death of this person, and this in turn led to revenge killings. The medicine men claimed power over wind and clouds and rain and snow and the seasons. Dr. Whitman told of one young cayuse who purposely shot himself right through the body twice in 2 years and then claimed to heal himself. And so he had great powerful medicine then among the cayuse. Now, the Whitmans settled into their station on the Walla Walla with Marcus very early holding services at a large Indian lodge morning and night on the Lord's Day, also instructing willing Indians in the doctrines of the Bible. Now, time doesn't permit me to tell you of the wide scope of the labors of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, including the long and dangerous trips Marcus often made to minister to the body and souls of the cayuses and also other Indians. Because he ministered to their souls, but he also, as a doctor, ministered to their bodies. He was involved in diagnosing and treating sick Indians. As you can imagine, with the medicine men around, this was not a real safe occupation for him, and he was threatened with death many, many times. Dr. Whitman also put a good deal of land under cultivation in order to make the mission station self-sustaining as possible, and also to be able to help others in need and to teach and guide the Indians into farming so they could live healthy lives, increase their lifespans, and avoid food shortages they were always having, lower their mortality rates. Early on, Dr. Whitman built a grist mill for making flour out of the grain he raised on the mission station fields, and eventually cattle were added to the enterprise, then hogs, and then orchards. In a letter concerning his efforts to train the Indians in agriculture that they might have a steady supply of food, Dr. Whitman stressed he was, quote, not forgetting that it is the gospel which we come to bring and that our great business is with that, with the soul and not the body. Eventually, Dr. Whitman built a sawmill and a blacksmith shop. He began training Indians in those useful trades and others, of course. As the years rolled on, he had helpers come from the East in answers to his call. Now, none of this enterprise was for the financial benefit of the Whitmans, contrary to what certain wicked men and women claimed. It was for the training and the benefit of the Indians. It was to supply the needs of the Whitman household, including a number of orphans they took in. It was to help supply and take care of the Indian students they were teaching, and eventually individuals added to the mission team. In time, at great expense to themselves, the Whitmans would also aid poverty-stricken immigrants. Once the Oregon Trail was opened up, and we'll talk about the opening of that in time and Marcus Whitman's part in it, but as they started arriving, these immigrants, and they needed food, he would help them. Sometimes they would stay at the mission station for an entire winter, and he would provide for them. And, of course, the Whitmans were all the time helping to feed the cayuse and training those that were willing in farming and other skills, as I had mentioned. Now, there were winters when the Whitmans eventually were feeding as many as 50 people for months. I might mention here that the Whitmans were very organized. You maybe guessed that by now. Very hard-working people. They personified the Protestant work ethic at its best. As to the children they raised, that is, the orphans they took in, they were what I would call good Puritan parents. They maintained a strict schedule for the children. They maintained a strict discipline with the children. And at the same time, they gave them no end of love and tenderness. Now, here I should also mention that in 1834, Methodist missionaries, Americans, had come to the west side of Oregon via ship to establish a mission in the Willamette Valley, which is right over by the coast, quite some distance from where the Whitmans were. So that was just 2 years before the Whitman party arrived. And, of course, they came overland from the east. The Whitman mission immediately formed a very warm friendship with these Methodist brethren, including the Reverend Jason Lee. You may have heard of him, even though the two missions were quite some distance apart. Now, on March 4th, 1837, Mrs. Whitman's 29th birthday, their only child was born, a girl they named Alice Carissa after her two grandmothers. The Indians, of course, including chiefs, thronged the house to see the little white baby. They called her Cayuse Timai, which is Cayuse girl. In a letter of March 12, 1838, Dr. Whitman wrote, "We find it a privilege if we can be the humble instruments of much good to the bodies and souls of the benighted Indians. Everything seems encouraging in our prospects, both as to instruction and cultivation. May the Lord bless us and direct our efforts in the best way among their people and make us a blessing to them." Now, by now, the Whitmans had a school with 15 to 20 Indians being taught to read the English language. Also, a number of children being taught to read. They had a regular church service. They had a Sabbath school for the young. Dr. Whitman also, of course, was traveling about, ministering the gospel to the Indians and caring for the sick. In the fall of 1838, reinforcements from the East arrived, including Reverends A.B. Smith, Elkanah Walker, Cushing Eales, and their wives, as well as a Mr. Cornelius Roberts. Now, the Walkers and the Eales were settled among the Spokane Indians to minister to them. Mr. and Mrs. Smith went to the Nez Perce. In a letter, Dr. Whitman wrote concerning the arrival of the brethren, he says, "We feel like Paul when he met the brethren from Rome. We thank God and we take courage." Now, in 1938, another arrival took place that greatly bothered Marcus Whitman and set some events in progress. This was the arrival of certain Roman Catholic Jesuit priests. The historian son of Reverend Eales wrote, "The arrival of Catholic missionaries about this time was a source of trial to Dr. Whitman, the first Vicar General F.N. Blanchett and Reverend M. Deemers, who reached Fort Walla Walla on November 18, 1838. Now, at that time, the man in charge of the Hudson Bay fort there at Walla Walla was a Roman Catholic. He immediately set about helping the priests. He was able to secure the Roman Catholic baptism of one of the principal Cayuses, and he worked very hard with the priests to keep the rest away from the Whitmans. In October of 1839, Mrs. Whitman wrote, "A Catholic priest has recently been at Walla Walla and held meetings with the Indians and use their influence to draw all the people away from us. Some they have forbidden to visit us again and fill all of their minds with distraction about the truth we teach and their doctrines. They say we have been talking about their," that's the Indians, "bad hearts long enough and too long. Say we ought to have baptized them long ago," etc., etc. "The conflict has begun. What trials await us, we know not." In a letter to the mission board written by Dr. Whitman the same month, he said, "The Indians say the priest represents to them one head priest who must be the Pope, that the head priest is very rich and sends all the goods to this country," which of course gives them the impression that he is the head of trade, "and that if they will come to him for instruction, they may be confident of having an abundance of favors," or in other words, presents. "The servants of the company, the Hudson Bay Company, are to a great extent Catholics." Now, a word here on the Whitmans, the Spauldings, and the Roman Catholics. The Protestant missionaries were, insofar as it depended on them, considerate and polite to the Roman Catholics and even the priests which they interacted with. They would never deny help to any person in need, no matter his religion. At the same time, they were very open and very plain-spoken concerning their abhorrence of the blasphemous doctrines and dogmas and rituals of popery. In fact, they made that crystal clear to the priests themselves from the Word of God. In 1839, an outbreak of cholera among both the Indians and the whites put Dr. Whitman in much demand. That same year, a printing press arrived for the use of the mission. It came from the Sandwich Islands, known today as the Hawaiian Islands. The first press on the Pacific coast had been sent originally in 1819 to the Sandwich Islands by the American Mission Board to be used there by missionaries. But after 20 years, it was too small for them. They needed a larger press, so they sent this other one to Dr. Whitman and Reverend Spaulding for use in the Oregon Territory. The first printing was a small booklet of 8 pages in the Nez Perce language, and then soon there was more Christian literature translated into the Indian languages and books, and eventually the Bible, and those were printed as the months and years wore on. Sunday, June 23rd, 1839, a parent's worst nightmare happened to the Whitmans, their only child drowned in the Walla Walla River. She was 2.5 years old. Mr. Spaulding preached the funeral service, saying, "She is the first of our number to find a grave in these dark regions." Mrs. Whitman wrote to her parents, "That we loved her most ardently is true, and it is no less true that we feel keenly the severe pangs of a separation from her who was so much joy and comfort of our hearts in our lonely situation. Yet it is the Lord that hath done it, and he hath dealt with us as a tender parent deals with his children whom he loves. I desire to ask you to unite with us in praise and gratitude to God, that he has so mercifully sustained me, and that, when crushed to the earth, because his hand lay heavily upon me, his grace was manifest to preserve and sustain my soul from murmuring or repining at his dealings with us. You know not, neither can I tell you, how much he comforts and sustains me in this trying moment. He enables me to say, 'The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed ever blessed be the name of the Lord.'" During the winter of 1840 and 1841, Dr. Whitman and his family were severely ill, following right on the heels of that tragedy. Meanwhile, the Whitmans' troubles with the Cayuse had only increased since the arrival of the Jesuit priests. Now, this is not to say that Dr. Whitman had no success among the Cayuse, but they were a people far more resistant to the gospel and the missionaries than other Indians to whom the Whitmans and their associates often ministered. The Roman Catholic priest from the start had far more success with the rich, proud Cayuse than with the other Indian tribes. Now the Cayuse were claiming absolute right to enter any room of the Whitmans' house at any time, day or night, for any reason or no reason. They also wanted the Whitmans to now pay rent on the land that they first gave them and which they begged them to settle on, the land which the Whitmans had so much used for their own benefit. I say the Indians' benefit and their children's good. They wanted Marcus to teach them only that part of the Bible they wanted to hear. They have their descendants today, don't they? They would sometimes turn their horses loose in the gardens and the fields and do other such things out of spite. And there was much stealing of articles belonging to the Whitmans and the mission. And it went further to violence already. Mrs. Whitman was threatened by an Indian with a hammer. In other instances, two Cayuse Indians came into the Whitman home armed with a hammer and an axe, and they attacked Mr. Gray and Dr. Whitman. There was a struggle, and those two men were able to disarm the Indians. Well, they left, but they came back with one swinging a club and the other armed with a loaded gun. By the grace of God, several other mission men came in, and the would-be murderers were again thwarted. Dr. Whitman was also physically attacked and punched by Indians on several other occasions. Yet Mrs. Whitman wrote this: "Our united choice would be to live and die here, to spend our lives for the salvation of this people. We have been contented and happy, notwithstanding all our trials, and let come what will, we had rather die in the battle than to retreat. If the Lord will only appear for us and remove all that is in the way of his salvation, take up every stumbling block out of our hearts and from this mission, and prosper his own cause here. Our ardent prayer is, Lord, let not this mission fail, for our board says it is the last effort they will make for the poor Indians." Well, we come now to epic events which caught the attention of the whole nation at that time, an epic event which has had a major impact on our nation's history. On October 3rd, 1842, Marcus Whitman left his mission station on the Walla Walla to travel well over 2,000 miles overland to the east. Now, there couldn't have been a worse time for him to undertake this journey. To start off in October through the mountains where it was already winter, and then across the windswept plains. His journey has been misrepresented by the enemies of the gospel, but the essential reason it was undertaken was for the cause of Christ and the gospel. There were two related reasons for what was subsequently called Whitman's Ride. First, the mission board in Boston had sent word that the work among the Cayuse and Nez Perce was to be discontinued. Reverend Spaulding and a number of other missionaries were to be discharged, sent back east, and the Whitmans were to transfer to the Spokane Indians. Now, in his writings, Marcus Whitman declared this to be tantamount to surrender, to surrendering the Indians to the devil and darkness and Oregon to Romanism. And so he determined that he must brave all dangers and sufferings in order to travel east immediately and show the board in person why their decision was a wrong one. And in that he was successful, as you will see. Now, secondly, individuals arriving in Oregon at this time had brought information to Dr. Whitman, which revealed that the United States was in great danger of giving up all claims to the Oregon Territory. You remember, according to the Treaty of 1818, USA and Britain shared joint possession. They had joint possession of the territory. But our nation had not made any effort to settle Americans there. So now powerful politicians in Washington were determined to trade off American rights to the Oregon Territory for other land held by the British in eastern Canada. Many members of Congress and the public felt that the Oregon Territory was far too isolated for it ever to be of any practical use to the rest of the country. The slave states were concerned that there would be more states coming into the Union if the USA didn't give up claims to Oregon. So Dr. Whitman was convinced the critical moment had come, which would decide if the Oregon Territory would be saved for the United States of America, for biblical Christianity and the free course of the gospel, or if it would be ceded over to Britain and the Hudson Bay Company and the soul-damning influence of Rome. Now, here again, I want to stress why, in a territory of Protestant England, during the greatest century of missions, popery would have so much influence. It all comes down to the Hudson Bay Company, the British company, which had a total trade monopoly on that area. Rome and the Roman Catholic priests didn't want the very Protestant United States of America, still full of Puritan influence and the heritage of the Reformation, to have the continent from sea to shining sea. And so Rome favored sole possession of the Oregon Territory by Britain. And not one missionary or minister, Protestant that is, had even come from Britain. And so they wanted the Hudson Bay Company, in truth, to keep the Oregon Territory. And the Hudson Bay Company, for this reason, was very favorable to the Jesuit missionary priests and their bishop. Meanwhile, the American missionaries were against the sole British possession of the Oregon Territory, and in fact, they favored sole possession of the United States of America, especially including because of the powerful influence the Catholic priests had with many officials with the Hudson Bay Company. Now, missionary A.B. Smith, previously mentioned, a co-laborer of the Whitmans in Oregon, although at a different mission station, wrote to the mission board in 1839, "The time has now come when we are convinced," speaking for all the missionaries there, "that what we do must be done quickly. Papacy is now making its appearance, and the errors of that church are beginning to be diffused among this people. At this time," September 13, 1839, "the Catholic priest is at Walla Walla instructing the people, and the Indians are gathering together there to listen to the false doctrines which he inculcates. Already has the priest denounced us because we have wives, and the people are told they are going to hell because they are unbaptized." In a letter to the mission board dated October 29, 1840, Marcus Whitman wrote of his concern, saying, "Will not the Catholics unite all the coasts from California to the north?" In a letter to Reverend and Mrs. Allen dated August 23, 1842, Narcissa Whitman wrote, "Romanism stalks abroad on our right hand and on our left, and with daring effrontery boasts that she is to prevail and will possess the land. I ask, must it be so? Does it not remain for the people of God in this and Christian lands to say whether it shall be so or not? Is not the Lord on our side? If he is for us, who can be against us? The zeal and the energy of the priests are without parallel, and many, both white men and Indians, wander after the beasts. Reverend Eales writes this: Dr. Whitman was fully alive to the efforts which the Roman Catholics were making to gain the mastery of the Pacific coast, and he was firmly persuaded that they were working in the interests of the Hudson Bay Company with a view to this very end. The arrival of the Bishop of Walla Walla with his clergy at the fort, says a Catholic historian, was a thunderbolt to the Presbyterian ministers, especially to Dr. Whitman. He was wounded to the heart by it. He could not refrain from expressing his great dissatisfaction, saying he would do all in his power to thwart the bishop. And then before we close, just one more quote, which gives a solid proof, and I will add to this proof in my next message, as to why Marcus Whitman determined to make what can only be described as an epic and heroic winter journey to Washington, D.C. This is from Reverend H.H. Spaulding, whose knowledge of the full scope of events covered by this two-part presentation was next to none, second to none, next to the Whitmans themselves. Reverend Spaulding tells of Dr. Whitman being called to Fort Walla Walla in October of 1842 in order to treat a sick man. While he was there, he ate a meal in the fort, a meal at which there was a great company of Hudson Bay traders and also a Roman Catholic bishop and some priests. Now, here I want to pick up with Reverend Spaulding's testimony. While this great company were at dinner, an express arrived from Fort Colville announcing to them, those present, glad news that the colony from Red River, British Canada, had passed the Rocky Mountains and were near Colville. An exclamation of joy burst from the whole table, at first unaccountable to Dr. Whitman, till a young priest, perhaps not so discreet as the older, and not thinking that there was an American at the table, sprang to his feet and, swinging his hand, exclaimed, "Hurrah for Columbia," that is Oregon. "America is too late. We have got the country." In an instant, as by instinct, Dr. Whitman saw through the whole plan, clear to Washington, Fort Hall and all. He immediately rose from the table and asked to be excused, sprang upon his horse, and in a short time stood with his noble cayuse, white with foam, before his door. He replied to our anxious inquiries with great decision and earnestness, "I am going to cross the Rocky Mountains and reach Washington this winter, God carrying me through, and bring out an immigration over the mountains next season, or this country is lost." In the second part, then, of my account of Marcus Narciso Whitman, I want to give more evidence, as I said, with regard to why this epic journey was undertaken. I want to tell about that heroic ride of Marcus Whitman to save Oregon. I want to tell about the amazing and crucial immigration of 1843, which Marcus led back to Oregon. And we have much more ground to cover concerning the lives, the ministry, and the deaths of Marcus and Narciso Whitman, including providing evidence as to the causes of the Whitman massacre. And so we'll pick up there this afternoon.